I have heard it suggested in certain quarters Hanukkah ought to be renamed as the festival of the overindulged child. Indeed, all of us will admit that in many ways it resembles a gauntlet thrown by harried and distraught parents to the December Santa Claus spirit which pervades. It's as if we were singing aloud to an unlistening world, anything you can do, I can do better. What? Presents on only one night? I'll give my children presents on each of 8 nights. Can you top this? I often feel as I read Hanukkah described in the mass media, there really ought to be an asterisk after the title and a line of type at the bottom of the page. Any resemblance between this holiday and the original holy day is purely coincidental. Actually, this distortion of Hanukkah is only the most recent of many reshapings which the holiday has silently suffered throughout the centuries. Just as this generation tends to make Hanukkah over in the image of Christmas, so our ancestors work to make Hanukkah over in the image of the 4th of July. The story deserves to be briefly told. The word Hanukkah, Hebrew, means dedication. The first Hanukkah, 2,127 years ago, celebrated the rededication, the repurification of a once despoiled and desecrated temple. In the year 168 before the Common Era, the Syrian Greek mercenaries of the Emperor Antiochus Epiphanes forcibly entered the temple, erected there an idol to the patron icon of the emperor, the idol Zeus Olympius, found an unscrupulous and ambitious priest who was willing to offer sacrifices to the idol in the name of the emperor. Jewish religious sensibilities were outraged. The Jewish people rose in rebellion. 35 months later, the guerrilla bands of Judah the Maccabee re-entered Jerusalem. They had recaptured all but the high-walled citadel, and their first thought was to the desecrated sanctuary. They pulled down the idol and they ground its plaster frame into dust underneath the boots of the soldiers. They pulled the polluted altar apart, stone by stone, rebuilt a new sanctuary. They carpentered the lattices and the gates of the temple, and they undertook an energetic cleanup operation that God's worship, Judaism, could be undertaken in the purity and the beauty of holiness. And it was decided that 1 month hence, on the 25th day of Kislev, a great celebration, a Hanukkah Habayit, a rededication would take place. The date was chosen symbolically. It had been on that very day 3 years before that the temple had been entered. Happy memories would replace the sad ones. And it was determined to celebrate the rededication for 8 days. Rereading their Bibles, these people recalled that in a similar purgation of the sanctuary 5 centuries before, King Hezekiah, having taken out the idols of the queen consort of his predecessor, King Ahaz, had ordered a celebration to last for 8 days. The people of the book followed the mandate of the book. Hanukkah became an 8-day festival. It was celebrated gloriously with song and gay procession and serious worship, and a great outpouring of emotion and of feeling. And at the climax of this first Hanukkah, the conqueror, Judah the Maccabee, got up on a rostrum and, with the thunderous, unanimous acclaim of his troops, the assemblage, proclaimed that an annual commemoration of this great moment should take place, bound all Israel to a yearly rehearsal of the events of that day. The spirit of this first Hanukkah was captured in a hymn, a psalm found in our Bible, which was probably, almost certainly, written for that very first Hanukkah celebration. I will extol thee, O Lord, for thou hast raised me up. Thou hast not suffered mine enemies to rejoice over me. O Lord my God, I cried unto thee, and thou didst heal me. O Lord, thou broughtest up my soul from the nether world. Thou didst keep me alive, that I should not go down to the pit. Sing praises unto the Lord, O ye his godly ones, and give thanks to his holy name. For his anger is but for a moment, his favor is for a lifetime. Weeping may tarry for the night, but joy cometh in the morning. Now I had said in my security, I shall never be moved. Thou hast established, O Lord, in thy favor, my mountain as a stronghold. Thou didst hide thy face, O Lord, and I was affrighted. Unto thee, O Lord, did I call, and unto the Lord I made supplication. What profit is there in my blood when I go down to the pit? Shall the dust praise thee? Shall it declare thy truth? Hear, O Lord, and be gracious unto me. Lord, be thou my helper. Thou didst turn for me my mourning into dancing. Thou didst loose my sackcloth. Thou didst gird me with gladness, so that my glory may sing praises to thee and not be silent. O Lord my God, I will give thanks unto thee for ever and ever. Weeping may tarry for the night, but with the morning there is such joy as we are experiencing now. God steadfastly safeguards his faith and his faithful. Be strong then, my people, and be of good courage. For whatever your present affliction, it shall pass. There is promise, there is hope. God vouchsafes that hope and that promise. This was and remains the elemental, basic teaching of Hanukkah. Within a generation, Hanukkah had been made over from a solemn religious holiday celebrating God's watchfulness of Israel to a holiday celebrating the national ambitions of those who had fought the battle of God for Israel. The descendants of Judah the Maccabee themselves were the first to distort the meaning of Hanukkah. Had Mattathias and his sons chosen the moment for rebellion, and they did not, it was imposed upon them by the rashness of an irascible emperor. Had they chosen the moment for rebellion, they could not have chosen a more propitious one. The two great Greek empires which divided the Near East, the empires which the historians label Seleucid and Ptolemaic, were in their dotage, enfeebled, rotting from within. No new empire had yet come to take over the mantle of authority. Had there been a strong, virile, powerful, well-organized central government at Antioch or Alexandria, these few guerrilla hillsmen of Judea would have been quickly put down. But as it was, the troops of Antiochus were committed on three fronts, against the Parthians in the east, against the Romans in the west, against the Egyptians to the south. There were two active contenders to the throne of Antiochus already in the field, and he had little time to worry about this gnat biting at his heel. The descendants of Judah the Maccabee took advantage of this power vacuum. And after 15 to 18 years of difficult, often bloody fighting, they are able to free Judea of its dependence upon the Syrian Empire, establish its independence, and win for themselves the throne. And they began to celebrate Hanukkah, not as a great festival of spiritual principle, but as a festival of coronation, a festival whose heroic history established the validity of their claim, the Maccabean-Hasmonean claim, to the throne of Israel. Hanukkah became associated with the theme of independence, political independence, though this had not been among the original purposes of the rebellion. Now, within a generation of political independence, the might of Rome was already begun to be felt in the Near East. The Hasmonean kings within a generation were satellites of Rome. Within another generation were puppets of Rome. Within the third generation were deposed by Rome. The Roman heel was something quite other than that of the Syrians and that of the Egyptians. Rome was ambitious. Rome was powerful. Rome was young. Rome was dynamic. And however oppressive or tyrannical or demanding Roman rule may have been, the hopes of a successful rebellion of the few against the many was foredoomed. And yet on each Hanukkah, courtiers of the deposed kings and the old warriors met with the young and with those who had grievance, and they rehearsed the great valor of the earlier day. And they challenged these men to screw up their courage, to be young, to strike for victory, to strike out for independence. And this challenge to one's manhood was then, as it is today, a heady wine. Many of the young were tempted to wield the sword against Rome, albeit this would have been a rash and foolish policy. Rash, because it was foredoomed. Foolish, because it would have jeopardized, as indeed it did subsequently, jeopardize the very religious freedom, the very integrity of one's own religious law, which Rome originally had allowed the Jews. And when this burning passion for independence could no longer be controlled, when the Jews in the year 68 of the Common Era, and again in the year 132 of the Common Era, did indeed rebel against Rome, they wrote a noble, heroic page in our history. But they succeeded only in having the walls of the temple leveled. Judea, not only captive, but despoiled to such a point that no vital Jewish life could continue in this ancient, beloved center, homeland. It was rash, it was folly to dream of rebellion. But Hanukkah was an annual occasion on which the blood ran hot, in which the ancient memories of the victory of the few were brought to consciousness, on which the rabble-rouser could mount the rostrum and incite the people into irresponsible action. So the rabbis, the leaders of the day, in their turn, conspired against Hanukkah. And the holiday of spiritual rededication became the holiday of national independence, became the holiday of God's great deliverance of Israel. It was ordained by the rabbis that there was to be no public celebration of Hanukkah. Hanukkah was to be a home holiday. To this day, there is no liturgy for Hanukkah. On the first day of Hanukkah, there are no public worship services in the synagogue. It was further ordained that on the one public occasion for worship during the week of Hanukkah, the Sabbath, which could not be obviated, which had to be celebrated, the biblical reading, Haftorah reading, should be the fourth chapter of the book of the prophet Zechariah, which included one unmistakable line of counsel: not by power, and not by might, but by my spirit, saith the Lord. Here was unmistakable preaching. And when the rabbis were asked by the people, my Hanukkah, what is Hanukkah? Why do we celebrate Hanukkah? They were told not to rehearse the valor of the Maccabees, but to explain Hanukkah with an ancient miraculous legend. The legend you know so well of the cruse of oil, which was found in the sanctuary by the troops of Judah the Maccabee. That cruse of oil which still had unbroken the seals establishing its purity, its fitness for temple worship. But a cruse whose contents were equal, whose volume was equal only to a single day. It took 8 days to refine and to mollify oil properly for the lights of the sanctuary. And yet through God's miraculous intervention, the lights burned with this oil for the 8 necessary days. God became again the central figure. Judah was pushed off stage. The menorah became the central ritual, reminiscent of the lights of the temple, God's miracle. The sword of Judah the Maccabee was put behind the scenes. The Bible was canonized during these very years, and deliberately the story of the Maccabees was hidden, set aside, kept out of the biblical canon. All was done with one single thought in mind, to teach the people that there are other forms of valor, other tests of manliness than the willingness to die on the battlefield. There is valor in patience, and there is valor in discipline principle, and that there are times when control, biding one's time, accepting the impossibility of rashness is the highest form of wisdom, the ultimate form for the service of God. As we all know, history never repeats itself. There are no exact parallels between one set of events and another. But surely in the challenge and response of one age, another age can find benefit. And so I believe it to be with this history of the holiday of Hanukkah and the tensions of our own day. For like the Jews of the first century, we too live under an atmosphere of niggling and sometimes vexing frustration. We too feel the hackles of our hair rising when the desks of the United Nations are pounded by our enemies. We too would love to have a world in which principle would win the day easily, effectively, in which our best intentions would not be thrown back in our faces by would-be friends and allies who misunderstand and misrepresent our actions. We too would enjoy a simple world of right and wrong, where right would always triumph. But it is not to be as it has never been. We too know the frustration of the Maccabees. We too know the frustration of the Jews of the first century. And we too are tempted, as the descendants of the Maccabees must have been tempted, to listen to the counsels of rashness, to the counsels of those who tell us to get it over with. To undertake a preventive war. We too are sometimes tempted to listen to those who tell us that we will achieve what we wish to achieve only by arms, only by being manly, as if manhood was proven only by one's willingness to march out into the smoke of battle. Now, unlike the Jews of the first century, we are our own masters. We determine our own domestic destiny. We can determine in large measure, though not completely, our international destiny. There is too much retaliatory power in the world for us to believe that we are masters of our own fate. But though we feel ourselves independent, free, We recognize in our heart of hearts that we are tied by the chains of humanity to all who live on the world. That we are tied by chains of political connivance and contrivance to all the nations of the world. That we are caught in like Laocoon in a series of cords which restrict us and preclude our having complete independence, freedom of action. We wish for it. We crave it. We are frustrated by its denial. We lack it. So too, again, we are tempted to cut with the sword the Gordian knot, to believe that we can somehow quickly and easily cut our way, cleave our way out, be free, unshackled and loosed. This is not to be, and it cannot be. Perhaps we would do well to listen to the rabbis of the first century, not by power, not by might, by my spirit, saith the Lord. The solutions of their day and the solutions of our day lie not on the battlefield. The solutions of their day and the solutions of our day are long-term, far-reaching, wide-ranging, and capable of any immediate answer. Man will be enmeshed in his problems as long as there are men. Though we win the battle, mankind has not won its war. But let it be remembered that the counsel of not by power, not by might, but by my spirit, saith the Lord, is not a counsel of passivity, not a counsel which encourages man to sit back in his rocking chair, to twiddle his thumbs, to gaze out at a maddening world proclaiming pathetically in a high voice his principle. Though the rabbis held peace to be quintessential, though the rabbis pleaded with the ambitious to curb their physical ambition, they did encourage all of their people to engage in war. Not the war of swords and spears and arrows, elephants and chariots, not the familiar war of our history books, the war against evil, the war against injustice, the war against privilege, the war against prejudice, the war against illiteracy, the war against all that roils and mucks goodness, the blessing which God has given us, which arrogates to the few the opportunity of the many, which takes away from all their God-given blessing. V'arta hara b'kir becha, said the rabbis, said the Bible, burn out the evil from your midst. Burn it out before you worry about burning the cities of another. Burn out the evil within you, within your cities. Seek peace and pursue it, the Bible says. Seek peace, pursue it. This is not, again, a counsel of inaction. This means label the enemy of peace. Label poverty. Label illiteracy. Label cruelty. Label demagoguery. Label ignorance. Set out to do something about it. Every time you eradicate an unjust law, every time you give another family, another city, another nation an opportunity which would not otherwise have been theirs, every time you establish a bond of humanity with another fellow being, every time you work that others may understand and open your ears that you yourself may understand, you build a brick in the house of peace, you lay a foundation pillar which will permit peace. Peace is not achieved simply by winning a war. Peace ultimately will be achieved only as we win the war of men against man, of the many against the few, the mass against the ambitious, of the servant against the tyrant. Seek peace and pursue it. There is no simple answer to this problem. When does one fight? When does one bide his time? Judaism kept both the Hanukkah of the Maccabees and the Hanukkah of the menorah. I read you in this morning the first book of the Maccabees, and it spoke of the valor of Judah. I have beside me on this altar the menorah, which speaks of the miracle of God's protection. There are times when the gates of madness are open in the world, when the gas chambers are burning, when it is necessary for men to stand up and take an unreasonable policy because there is no reason in a pathological world. But these times are few. These are moments in extremis, ultimate moments, moments such as faced the Jews in the days of Antiochus and again in the days of Hitler. But as long as we have our freedom and our independence, as long as our backs are not up to the wall, far better it is if we follow the spirit of the menorah. Faith and trust in God, patience and discipline and control and dispassion in our judgments, a determination to enroll ourselves as soldiers, soldiers of peace corps, soldiers who will go out into our families, into our cities, into our countries, build rather than destroy. You steal for building rather than for bloodletting. Equip not armies, but schools. Cut down forests for roads that will lead to markets and to centers, but not to battles. This is our challenge. This is the challenge of Hanukkah. The work of the righteous shall be peace. The work of the righteous shall be peace.